You're listening to Atheistically Speaking.
Okay, and for this next segment, I wanted to include a little bit in this show of some counter-apologetics, because it's something that I tend to enjoy, and I think that it can be fun and it can be useful to go over popular arguments that you might hear if you ever happen to have to confront a believer. And so for this week's version, we have William Lane Craig, and I will link this article in the show notes, but we'll also read over it. It's from foxnews.com. Again, Fox News. We're not going to be totally Fox News centric, but just happened to be that these two are Fox News. And he wrote a Christmas gift for atheists, 5 reasons why God exists. And the quick thing I wanted to say about this is I think that this guy claims to be a philosopher. And I'm sure a lot of you have experience with him, but David can speak to this more because he has a degree in philosophy. I took a few classes and I love it, but I'm nowhere near his level of expertise. But in my limited experience with philosophy, what I did find was that there's a difference between a good philosophical argument, which may end up being wrong, and this. Like, I remember reading people's positions sometimes that there would be an argument and it's convincing, but you'd end up reading someone later on who said, no, I think that's not true because of this or whatever. And it's like, okay, it has maybe one flaw, one place where they went wrong. But for this particular article, I'm pretty sure if David and I came up with our top 5 reasons why all of these arguments are wrong, they might not even include the same things. Like, there's so many things wrong with this. It's such lazy corner cutting thinking that it's just appalling.
The worst thing too with something like this, almost anything that you ever see by William Lane Craig is like this. He has the audacity to say that he's a philosopher and then writes from the clear position of someone who's never read anything or taken anything. Well, I'm sure he's read it, but maybe not taken seriously any counter argument. Yeah. He doesn't address any counter argument to anything ever said against him.
Yeah. And another thing that he does that's my favorite is that when a scientist or a astrophysicist says something that he agrees with, that's the gospel truth. Like, he presents it like, scientists have said that they, say that, and that's just stands. But when it's a scientist that goes against what he says, then it's like, well, this is just one man who, this is just wrong. Like, he picks and chooses which scientists that he wants to agree with. And the ones he picks that he agrees with, he talks about them like they're just infallible.
He does that here in the first one. Do you just kind of want to get into it?
Yeah, go ahead and you can tackle the first one.
So his point number one, God provides the best explanation of the origin of the universe. He says, given the scientific evidence we have about our universe and its origins, and bolstered by arguments presented by philosophers for centuries, it is highly probable that the universe had an absolute beginning. Since the universe, like everything else, could not have merely popped into being without a cause, there must exist a transcendent reality beyond time and space that brought the universe into existence. This entity must therefore be enormously powerful. Only a transcendent, unembodied mind suitably fits that description. Oh, there's so many things here. And it's such a common kind of terrible, crappy argument, but it's hilarious. It's hilariously bad.
Yeah.
So
to pick one of my favorite things, and we can just kind of go back and forth on this because I'm sure there's lots of things until we consider it officially a dead horse that we've kicked into oblivion. Well, I'll tackle the easier one. I think that you probably have some more sophisticated things you could say about the universe and the transcendent reality that might exist. But my favorite simple thing is only a transcendent unembodied mind. Like, he just jumps to this. The concept of an unembodied mind, we know for a fact, and I think that he's someone who accepts evolution, I'm pretty sure. I don't think he argues against evolution. I think he thinks that it goes with his worldview, And so it's funny that we know that minds are a product of evolution. There's an unembodied mind that doesn't make any sense. It's just a concept you can invent using language. I mean, pre-language, I don't think we would be able to even come up with that concept, right? I mean, to be able to attach these two ideas, like, yeah, it's a mind, but also it doesn't have a body and is independent of, you know, evolution and biology. Like that doesn't actually make sense. Just because you can imagine it, it doesn't, that how could there be a mind the outside of the universe? It doesn't make any sense.
That last bit of argument too is argument from lack of imagination.
Yeah.
It says only a transcendent, unembodied mind suitably fits that description. Let's assume that all the rest of his, argument, all the rest of his whatever is true and right on the money. And then this sort of last bit is, oh, well, the only thing I can think of that fits this is an unembodied mind. Well, but if someone else could think of something else, I mean, by the structure of what he's saying.
Yeah, I could think of a million things. For one, I could think of how about like four unembodied minds. I always love to go on their level and then think like one more of that. How about like 60 gods that all are like not very smart, but together, you know? The idea that it's transcendent and all knowing. I love how that just somehow follows. Like,
yeah, right.
We don't have to, even in our human example, if we create something, it's not like we know every single thing that goes on inside that thing at all times just by virtue of having created it. You know, like you can set something into motion. Like hypothetically, maybe there could have been some entity that, you know, set the little spark going, but didn't really know what was going to happen. It doesn't necessarily follow that they're just going to know everything at all times and be able to hear our thoughts somehow, like they created the universe. How does that work? I don't know. It's just, there's so many little ways that it doesn't follow. Like the argument just does not follow to where he wants to get it to. It's even if you grant like a number of his, of his premises.
The bit that gets me, and it gets a lot of people who've studied physics or really any kind of astronomy or anything like that, since the universe, like everything else, could not have merely popped into being without a cause. I mean, he is right in that there are a lot of scientists do believe that if the universe did have a beginning, there was some cause that created the mm-hmm. Big Bang, you know, as people say. But it's a silly question in some ways to ask. Well, what was before then? Well, we have no access to that. We have no access to that kind of information. And what is it? It's not really answering a whole lot. It's not getting us anywhere. It's not productive. There is this kind of complicated scientific argument there. Was there a cause? Was there not a cause? Is it worth talking about or is it not worth talking about? But he just glosses over all of that.
Right.
It must exist, a transcendent reality, which is just kind of, you know, start with something that is vaguely scientific and that some scientists find interesting and then just go somewhere ridiculous from there.
Let me see what you think of this, because whenever he and other people have made this argument, this is what I think of. And I'm wondering if this passes muster with someone who has more dealings in philosophy than I do. I always think when people always say everything has a cause, I always think, well, we don't have any experience with anything like that. We only have one example of something that popped into existence, and it's the universe, really. I mean, if you want to say, like, where are you getting that idea that everything that comes into existence has a cause? All you're getting that from is, like, bigger, tangible things. But those are just combinations of smaller things that come and go. You know, like, when you're talking about cause and effect, like, a chemical reaction, that's, in a way, that's a cause. But those two things were always there before. You know, it's not... The only example that you have that you're drawing off of is the universe coming from nothing. So it's sort of redundant, isn't it? I mean, where is he getting the idea that everything that comes into existence needs a cause? I think kind of agrees with what you were saying. Like, where do you get that?
Yeah, right. I think that is... A lot of people think this way. This is the way that I've always experienced things. This is the way that I've always thought of things. Therefore, everything must fit into this way of thinking.
I think that his intuitions and our intuitions and almost a lot of our logic, which I think is incredibly useful and is usually right, it is built off of our evolutionary understanding and dealings in the world, right? I mean,
yeah, right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I think that's where this comes from. I didn't word it exactly how I wanted to, because I forgot that I was going to mention this, but, that's sort of where that premise comes from, would you call that a, I don't know what, I guess you would call it a premise, yeah, that right. everything that,
well, even what counts as a cause is so determined by what we have access to in yeah. the world. You know, any sufficiently advanced technology is basically magic to,
right.
you know, a sufficiently unadvanced, a culture, I guess. Mm-hmm. And that's not really that surprising, because they don't understand what the causes may be. And in this way, I guess you would think of cause as an explanation of, you know, you plug the TV in and, you know, and kind of describe how everything works.
Yeah.
And that's really what it is. The things that we can't describe right now, I mean, can simply be a limitation of what we can know or what we can possibly know.
Yeah.
Or even what a cause may be in the realm of the very, very small. When you're looking at uncertainty of a particle, of the position of a particle, I guess you could say there's a cause for the particle to be in one position or to at least to be there. But we really have no way of saying why it adopts one location as opposed to another.
All we can do is give the probability equation, right?
Well, right. Yeah. And if we want to talk about the more precise we try to get in one way, it becomes less precise, precision. You know?
Yeah, and I think what I was trying to say, and maybe you did grab it out of what I was saying, or maybe not, is that all of our experience that is telling us this premise of there can't be everything that exists has to have a cause, all of our experience that ties that premise to the real world is all not actually that. It's all just not seeing the smallest levels of things. Right? I mean, there's nothing that we have everyday experience with that is, okay, there was nothing here and then there was something. We only have one example of that, and we have no access to why it came to be, right? I mean, I guess
right.
I've heard physicists talk about that things do pop in and out of existence at a quantum level, that things pop in and out of existence, but that's not where our intuition for this comes from. I think it comes from sort of just a tangible kind of, you know, working with objects in the world at a macro level, everything we've built, it's because we built it. But yeah, but the ingredients were always there. We don't have any examples of things that came from nothing, you know? So we can't apply that principle. He just invented that principle from a surface understanding of things, I think. I don't know. Do we want to move on to the next one? Or?
Yeah, sure. You want to read the next one?
Sure. So number two... So now, I don't know why we're going on, because number one is where he killed that one. Or are they not in sequence? Maybe they're all different. I suppose they're all different angles. So number two is, God provides the best explanation for the fine tuning of the universe. Contemporary physics has established that the universe is fine. I wish I could do a good impression of it. It's fine tuned for the existence of intelligent, interactive life. I think that's pretty close, right? That is to say, in order for intelligent, interactive life to exist, the fundamental constants and quantities of nature must fall into an incomprehensibly narrow life-permitting range. There are three competing explanations of this remarkable fine-tuning: physical necessity, chance, or design. The first two are highly implausible, given the independence of the fundamental constants and quantities from nature's laws and the desperate maneuvers needed to save the hypothesis of chance. That leaves design as the best explanation. That last sentence is terrible. Or second to last sentence is absolutely terrible.
Well, it's funny. The second to last sentence, I think, he just kind of washes away what is, in my opinion at least, really the best argument there.
Yeah.
If by chance the fine-tuning of the universe weren't such that there were intelligent, interactive life. I don't know why interactive is so important to him.
Yeah.
But if it weren't that way,
it's true.
We wouldn't be talking about this. In a universe where gravity is just a little bit stronger or just a little bit weaker, we just wouldn't be talking about this. And it wouldn't be a, you know,
I'd still talk about it.
Important at all.
No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, you, I'd be there.
You're the one.
I don't require that much gravity. I'm pretty good.
You know, but it's, I'm an exception. It's a silly idea that it's kind of like the first one, I guess, talking about something that's sort of silly to talk about.
Would you say, though, I think I would say that this is likely the best argument for God. Like, if there, of all the arguments there are, not to say that it's necessarily good, I kind of think this would be the best one to me.
No, I think it's terrible.
Well, I'm not saying it's good. I'm just, I can't think of one that is more convincing than when you look at the odds. Because, like, when they do map out, and maybe they're misrepresenting their numbers, but when they map out, like, the odds that, you know, this force would be this strong, you know, the atomic force or whatever, it presents it in a somewhat compelling way. I don't find it compelling. I'm just saying I think he maybe, like you said, maybe he washed over, like, probably the best argument that he has.
Yeah, no, it is true that there's very, very, very little wiggle room in the constants that really define the forces and the way that things interact in the universe. There's a very, very fine range that if it's too great or too small, then you wouldn't be able to have spheres orbiting stars or stars would never start to emit heat and light, you know.
Yeah, or they wouldn't get past the phase that creates the denser particles or whatever it is.
Right, right. But it's, I guess to me, I think of it as it's entirely conceivable that the electroweak force was a little bit weaker in another universe or in some hypothetical universe. And that's an interesting thought. And then one might say, oh, but there wouldn't be intelligent life in that universe. And then you go, yeah, you're right. There wouldn't be. Moving on now. You know, like there's no God in there at all.
You know,
it's just saying,
well,
what would happen if the forces were different? And you go, oh, well, stars would look like this or people wouldn't exist. Life couldn't exist. Okay.
Yeah, I just think, and I get the feeling, though, because I watch a lot of talks, like Lawrence Krauss and that kind of thing. And I get I can't think of a specific, but I tend to get the idea that people sort of sneer at the multiple universes kind of theory, don't they? I mean, it doesn't seem that way to you. They sort of, and maybe it's because there really can't be any evidence for it as of right now. We can't, you know, we can't.
Yeah, I think it's because that became really big as part of string theory. That was one thing that string theory sort of pushed along. And as string theory becomes increasingly less popular, I guess.
Right.
Anything associated with it is then kind of brought down as well.
Right, but when you're dealing with, okay, we're talking about, there's some sort of, I don't know what the proper wording would be, but if there's some sort of realm or frame of existence of which our universe is just a part, then all bets are off, right? I mean, maybe there are infinite, if time is a property of our universe, so time isn't a constraint, you know, like there's infinite time available, or that's not even the best way to say that. There's no time. So, you know, in terms of there being multiple universes, that's not a constraint. There can be millions and zillions and infinite happening simultaneously with, you know, like, so all bets are kind of off, right? I mean, unless we have some way to measure what's going on outside of our universe, which I don't know how that could even be possible, but who knows, maybe. We can't really say either way. And I think that religious people, what I've heard William Lane Craig say in the past is that he'll say, well, scientists, in order to deal with the, you know, vast plausibility of the fine tuning, they've tried to do things like invent multiple universes for which they have no evidence. And so they're just like, believers. That's what they'll say. Or that's what he'll say. And I guess what I'm trying to say is like, well, that's just one possibility. I mean, I suppose there's no evidence for that. But is there any, do we have any reason to think the other way, though? I mean, do we have any evidence that our universe would be the only one or that it couldn't be a part of a multiverse? I mean,
I'm sure there is, I don't know if you want to, you know, evidence one way or the other,
right?
In both directions, people really invested in this idea and doing the hard, you know, math that's required that might have a lot more interesting things to say about it. But I think the kind of work that they're doing is totally unrelated to this idea that the fine tuning in some way is related to whether there is intelligent life beyond anything except for the possibility of intelligent life being a happenstance of the way that the constants exist in our universe. You know, I think that's just uninteresting to them. Hmm. So there is this very interesting topic of, are there multiple universes? Are there not? What might the constants be in these other universes? Is it possible that they may be different? But there's no interesting connection between that and whether intelligent life exists or not.
Yeah. I think that in terms of talking about something outside our universe, I just think all bets are off. Honestly, it 100%. And I don't know if you'll agree with this or not. It could be that there's some other life that exists in a realm outside, you know, and sort of above, you know, hierarchically, I guess, like above our universe. There could be some sort of life that maybe could have created something like our universe. You know, like, I mean, I think that's not completely impossible, similarly to how we could create a simulation that would be an entire universe, like that kind of thing. I mean, that's possible, yeah, right? I mean, but what I'm saying is that doesn't mean that whoever the creator is would be this all-knowing, you know, like the kind of God that he's talking about. There's absolutely no reason to believe that. I mean, it seems pretty implausible. It could be a multitude of creators. It could be many people working together who don't, yeah, you know, it's clear from other evidence about the world that they don't really care about what happens here. So like there's, you know, yeah, there's,
I guess, I mean, I don't disagree that it is sort of theoretically possible, or maybe not even theoretically, I guess I hate, cause I really do hate that phrase. It's,
no, really? Just because it's like redundant?
Because it's so, yeah, it's so overused. And,
yeah.
But I do think that it is possible, but because we have at least currently no access,
right,
to that kind of information, I'm just tempted to say, who cares?
Yeah, like, it's not, I totally,
it doesn't affect,
agree,
anything at all.
I totally agree. There really is. But I'm just saying, the only reason I bring it up is because if you want to grant them this premise, sure, Maybe it could be the constants are fine tuned, but you have no idea why that is, and neither do I. And maybe we'll make some discovery about it, but we really don't know that right now. So
yeah, that's good.
That's all I'm trying to say. Okay, one.
I think we should move on to the next one.
Move on to the next one.
All right. So we have number three. God provides the best explanation of objective moral values and duties. Even atheists recognize that some things, for example, the Holocaust, are objectively evil. But if atheism is true, what basis is there for the objectivity of moral values we affirm? Evolution? Social conditioning? These factors may, at best, produce in us a subjective feeling that there are objective moral values and duties, but they do nothing to provide a basis for them. If human evolution had taken a different path, a very different set of moral feelings might have evolved. By contrast, God himself serves as the paradigm of goodness, and his commandments constitute our moral duties. Thus, theism provides a better explanation of objective moral values and duties.
We really could do like an entire show on each one of these things.
It's true. I know. We're going so long on them. They're so...
Yeah, well, this will definitely be two-parter and stuff. But just real quick, I wanted to say that I do want to do probably a whole episode on kind of atheism and morality. So we might not kind of get too deep into it now.
Yeah, that's
but
fine.
Just to provide some summary. Go ahead if you wanted to tackle that one first.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I actually think up until, let's see, these factors may at best produce in us the subjective feeling that there are objective moral values and duties. I think that's
true.
That's true, yeah.
And
right.
The funny thing is, though, that he starts with, even atheists agree that things really feel evil. But this, at best, produces the subjective feeling of evil. Wait a minute. That's what you just said, right? He somehow... I don't know how he's trying to get around that. He says, even atheists recognize that some things are objectively evil. I guess he's saying that that's beyond a feeling. Well, I don't know why that's necessarily beyond a feeling. I think that's could be just a feeling, right? Mm-hmm. And then he goes on to explain that evolution explains... could explain subjective feelings of... morality.
Yeah, this is all great until his last two sentences, as soon as he brings in God himself serves as the paradigm of goodness. I think it's,
that's true, because if human evolution, this is, I'm reading from it again, if human evolution had taken a different path, a very different set of moral feelings might have evolved. That's 100% true.
Yeah, right. And I take the approach for stuff like this that it sounds, the way he's phrased it, sounds very dry and like a horrible world to live in. But if we just accept it and live with it and think that, oh, okay, so it's because of the way we've evolved and the way that our brains work that we have these subjective feelings that give meaning to the moral decisions that we make and make us thankful for people who do things that we think of as morally just. I mean, that's amazing. That's incredible.
Yeah.
That our brains work that way and that we're able to interact with other brains and do this insane thing. And if you, put it in, if you're interested in putting it in the context of evolution and as that's where it came from, that's really interesting. But because it's like what I care about, the moral decisions that I care about are the ones that you make and that my family makes and the ones that I make, right? And when all of those come together and things are going well for me, that's what makes me happy and gives them meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they came from evolution or God never plays into my satisfaction of the moral interactions I have with people around me.
My favorite thing about this is, and this is a, like in the last example, this is something I always think about when I hear him say this. I always think about this parallel argument of the Beatles where I say, look, we all know that the Beatles are objectively just the best band that there is. And then you say, well, what about someone who is born maybe and doesn't like the Beatles? Well, they're just wrong. It's like, how do you, wait a minute. You just accept that, there are people who didn't think the Holocaust was evil. It's called the Nazis. And it's like, well, they're just wrong about it. Well, why? Because I feel that it's evil. Like, okay, I think I agree that it's evil. But not for that reason, not for the reason that you and I and a few other people feel that it was evil. It's not, feelings aren't the reason it was evil. The reason it was evil is because it was terrible to the well-being of the people involved. Like it was really bad for them and it caused pain and suffering and death. And that's why it was wrong. Not because I really feel that it's evil,
Right, right.
It's funny that because there are people, what does he say? I really want to ask him what he thinks about people, about psychopaths, about they're just born without this, like what, how does he account for that? There are people born who just don't feel this, who have no feeling of something being objectively evil. How is he going to convince that person?
They must be possessed. They're possessed by, an evil demon.
Yeah, exactly. They just have to kill him. How is he going to convince that person that there's objective evil? There's no way. He would have to argue. This argument only works when you're talking about things that people just happen to agree with. Like when you're talking about maybe, well, okay, A, when you're talking to a psychopath who doesn't have any of these feelings, it'll break down. And B, when you're talking about issues that are maybe a little more nuanced, you can't just appeal to this feeling, You can't say like, I don't know, let's say the tax rate. I don't know. Poverty and taxing the rich. You can't say, well, we all feel that it's evil for, you can't use that argument because clearly there's going to be differences in how people feel.
Well, on top of that, I think some people's moral feelings, even people I would think of as good people, are pretty terrible. You have your people pleasers that just can't say no. They just can't do it. And in any circumstance, they'll always do, anything that anybody asks of them, even to the long-term detriment of that person.
Yeah.
And so they're doing a harm, but they think they're doing a good thing because they have this feeling that it's the right thing to do to help, or maybe not even help, just to give this person whatever it is that they're wanting or asking for. Socially
to do it.
Out of this feeling that it's wrong to let people down or say no. And that's terrible,
Yeah, or related to that, what comes to my mind is like charity, and how like Peter Singer's kind of a lot of his thoughts on how we give poorly to charity, or we're not affected by certain things and we're affected by others. Like our moral intuitions in terms of that are terrible. Like we probably should honestly be giving a lot of our money all the time to save a lot of lives, but because we don't see the people involved, we don't care.
Yeah. I remember, I can't, I don't remember where I saw this from, but there's some interesting work that has been done on trying to understand how many people, other people, the average person is able to empathize and sympathize with. And it's, from what I remember, it's something like 100 or so.
And it's why, right. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I think
you hear of these atrocities.
Once
or you
it gets,
can read
the
about,
number gets too
you know,
high.
Death on Wikipedia, and it doesn't really faze you. It doesn't really affect you.
Right. Right. Once you get past a certain number of, like, deaths, it's like, yeah, okay. It just becomes, like, one thing. Like, all right.
People think of, you know, 6 million people died, and then 7 million people died, and people don't panic and freak out over the difference. But
yeah,
if you were to just to say a million people died, you're like, holy shit.
Yeah.
A lot of people died.
That's true. I don't know. Those numbers sound the same to me. Doesn't even.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but we're also two atheists talking about this, so that's probably, that might be why.
Oh, we're all disconfigured. We don't have, yeah.
Yeah, right.
Discombobulated,
right.
Morally. Yeah.
This is good. I think there's more on this that we could say.
Oh,
yeah,
definitely.
Forever and ever and ever.
Yeah, maybe we should cut it short because we want to do a longer episode on it sometime. But that's, I just love the idea that he just picks, he tries to pick an extreme example that everyone can relate to and then use that to say, see, everyone knows it, you know, but like, it doesn't hold up for almost everything else. I mean,
well, there's this other interesting bit, just real quick. I want to add in. So the Holocaust objectively being evil, without getting into philosophical arguments of does objective morality exist or not, there were a lot of people who participated in the Holocaust that were caught and tried at the end and were found to have been caught up in this social movement, and they were actually allowed to go free.
Mm.
You know, people tried them, and they were like, well, yeah, you kind of were a police officer and you did help shuffle people into the trains and do this. And they weren't always necessarily punished.
Yeah.
And a lot of people had to do this. You know, it wasn't a few people that participated in this or in Russia. It's not like a few people sent, you know, people off into Siberia. I mean, it takes a lot of people to get this infrastructure to kill that many people.
Yeah.
And they weren't all, you know, condemned as these horribly immoral criminal people. So there's interesting stuff there too that I think never gets talked
about. Yeah, maybe I'm not even that great of a person. I'm just too lazy to kill that many people. Maybe that's that's the only thing. Maybe I am evil. I don't know. I could be Hitler. I just sounds like work. I don't know.
Yeah. Maybe that's the only difference between Hitler and all of us other atheists.
Yeah.
Hitler was just a really, really hard worker.
Right. Yeah, okay. So okay, more on that in future episodes. Because I think that's a big, morality with atheism, I think is a big, big topic. And I think it has a pretty big effect on how people live their lives and stuff. So, number 4, God provides the best explanation of the historical facts concerning Jesus' life, death, and resurrection. Okay, this is,
can we just stop here?
Get
Who
too
cares
easy.
About the rest of this? Right. I mean, talk about putting the cart before the horse here.
Okay, so I'm not going to read through this crap. He thinks that Jesus is God is the best explanation for. Nah, I do want to read it. Historians have reached something of a consensus that the historical Jesus thought that in himself, God's kingdom had broken into human history, and he carried out a ministry of miracle working and exorcism as evidence of that fact. Moreover, historians believe that, really. Moreover, most historical.
Well, no, historians believe that Jesus thought that. That's fine.
Sure. But, until he says carried out a ministry of miracle working like that, how can he, you know what
okay,
I mean? Like
yeah,
that, that's
right.
Where he lost me. He thought that, but if he would have worded it like, and maybe and thought he was doing miracles or something. Moreover, most historical scholars agree that after his crucifixion, Jesus's tomb was discovered empty by a group of female disciples that various individuals and groups saw appearances of Jesus alive after his death. And that the original disciples suddenly and sincerely came to believe in Jesus' resurrection, despite their every predisposition to the contrary. I can think of this.
Is
the definition
predisposition,
of
so that before he died, they didn't believe in his resurrection? Well, he wasn't dead yet.
Right, right. And this is a textbook example of argument from lack of imagination. I can think of no better explanation of these facts than the one that the original disciples gave. God raised Jesus from the dead.
Oh, man.
Yeah, this one is not exactly.
Yeah. You summarize it as historians believe that these other people believe these things.
Yeah.
Therefore, I believe it too. Okay. All right.
Yeah, and also there's just almost nothing about Jesus that doesn't come from the Bible, right? I mean, I don't think it's in dispute whether or not he existed. It seems like he did. I know some people question it, but I'm pretty sure that the consensus among academics is that he did exist, but there's nothing else documenting what he did, really. I mean, it all comes from the Bible. That's the only source. And the Bible was written decades and decades after the people, you know, after the fact, you know, by people who weren't there. It was written by, you know, word of mouth, but, you know, it's just 9/11 happened 10 years ago and a significant percentage of people can't even understand that it happened. They have like different beliefs about it. And in this day and age, tons of cameras, it was on the news. People saw it happen live, but no, they still can't agree on what exactly happened. A significant percentage. I think it's like 10 or 15%, right? Of truthers. It's a lot.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And the idea that like somehow it's just infallible that these people saw this happen is ridiculous, especially when you take into account, well, okay, like in this day and age, hypothetically, what if the 10 to 15% of truthers, what if they happen to maybe multiply and conquer other countries? And, you know, that it's a little weird to think of that nowadays, but if we were in a different historical time, you could imagine, well, what if this small percentage of people happen to be geographically located together and happen to prosper more than other people and conquer other countries and do that kind of thing? That would just become the version of history. I mean, when you get enough people in that day and age, right? I mean, it eventually would just become not very challenged, you know, because the majority hold that viewpoint. And in that day and age, there wasn't the technology and the, you know, resources to go back and just look at the video like you can with 9/11. So yeah, the example kind of breaks down a little bit, but anyway, okay. So we've done with that layup.
Yeah. I just feel like that one's just so terrible. I don't even have anything else to say about it. That's the last one might be just as bad. Here's number 5. God can be personally known and experienced. The proof of the pudding is in the tasting. Down through history, Christians have found through Jesus a personal acquaintance with God that has transformed their lives. I mean,
wow. What did everybody do before 2000 years ago?
I don't know.
They just sucked. They had terrible lives. Couldn't do anything.
Yeah, know, right. I mean, that's a lot just of terrible. People.
That's all of basically Asia, right? Like, and other places. That's like the most densely populated places.
All of
in
Southern
the world.
Africa. They had
for,
no idea.
For thousands
for a long
of
time.
Years. And there's still most, I mean, unfortunately, you know, more and more people are being converted these days, but for a long time, there was an entire history of people, of millions of people who lived independently of this bullshit myth that we're doing just fine. They had lives and you know, probably had
well, happiness. And number, this last argument is just, it strikes me how insanely embedded William Lane Craig is in his own personal view of the world, how impossible it is for him to think of any other perspective. Maybe he's one of these sociopaths that's just unable to do this because in writing number 5, like, here's what a good philosopher writes. They sit down, they write that whole bit and they think, well, shit, that applies to every other religion.
Yep.
And then they erase it and realize it's stupid, you know, but he
that
never
applies
does this.
In fill in the blank where God is in that sentence. Just put anything,
right. Put any sufficiently, you know, large followed religion.
Groundhog Day can be personally known and experienced.
Santa Claus can be personally known and experienced. Yeah. The proof is in the pudding. Down through history, Americans have found through Santa a personal acquaintance with gift giving that has transformed their lives.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Pudding can be personally known and experienced. The proof of pudding is in the table.
Right.
And I'm not about to believe the pudding exists, so yeah.
It is funny to read some of this stuff, though, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and some of it, like, you know, some of it's more convincing than other things, you know?
Yeah, right.
Not that, yeah, none of it's terribly convincing, but one thing I do want to try to do with the show, if at all possible, is try to represent the best of the other side of whatever we're talking about. You know, like, I don't know that this is that, but I do want to stay in touch with the the arguments against whatever we're talking about and whatever we believe. And maybe we'll find better ones and that'll be more interesting. But I don't, you know, it's annoying that it's probably true that no believers really believe because of these arguments. I don't know what you think about that, but unfortunately, I don't really think any believers, any Christians are really came to their Christianity through these arguments. You know,
I don't think so. I think very few of them have. And I also hope that we can come up with some very good counter arguments to what we're saying. Maybe we'll get lucky and a listener will hear something and contact us, you know, write us a good
counter
argument to something that we've said.
Yeah, when we kind of get the, this is the first episode, so of course things are going to start a little slow, but I'm hoping, you know, a lot of my listeners will jump in and hopefully we'll branch out and get other listeners and, you know, we can kind of have a little Facebook community going. I think that's the best thing that a lot of other podcasts do. They have a Facebook page and then they, you know, they can post stuff and people can comment and we can bring that up when someone writes us something that's thought out, you know, we can bring it up on the show.
Yeah, it sounds good.
So that's it for this week's episodes. Tune in next Monday when we're going to talk about the online atheist community as well as whether or not atheism is for the privileged.